From the City of Angels off the Pacific Ocean, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie. Welcome to Coast AM. Next hour, mega catastrophes with Dr. David Darling as we go live to the United Kingdom. Here's what's happening. Well, here we go as the 2011 Bilderberg meeting kicks off in Switzerland. Radio host Alex Jones out there has called for activists around the world to descend on the luxury hotel there this Saturday, 12 noon local time, to protest the secretive global confab. As the Bilderberg Group operates behind closed doors, it attracts very little mainstream media attention, despite the fact that hundreds of the world's most important CEOs, banking elites, politicians, influential media figures annually attend to discuss worldwide policy. A large-scale peaceful protest would draw media attention to the gathering and help further expose the group's history and previous actions. Alex is particularly calling on Swiss nationals to bolster the numbers by joining the small gathering of alternative media journalists out there and activists that are already on the site. The Virginia 2-year-old who died from an E. coli bacterial infection that was also sickening her brother, as well as 10 other people in Tennessee since June 1st, apparently are unrelated to the infections in Germany. That's what they say. And cucumbers now, they say, are back on the radar of German health officials as the possible cause of the E. coli outbreak in Europe that has killed at least 26 people, sickened over 2,700. 2 weeks ago, investigators blamed cucumbers from Spain. They ruled it out. They then blamed it on sprouts from an organic farm in Germany. They ruled it out. Now they're going back to the cucumbers. Bottom line, they don't know what's going on. Tomorrow night on Coast to Coast AM, an expert's going to be with us, Charles Ostman. He believes there could be some bioengineering involved here. The Food and Drug Administration has added new warnings to the cholesterol drug Zocor, cautioning doctors that the highest dose of the drug can cause muscle damage, including potentially lethal kidney damage in rare cases. Regulators said the patients taking the 80 milligram dose of Zocor, a statin drug, have a higher risk of muscle damage than patients taking lower doses of the drug. The warning also applies to generic versions of the drug as well. Reporter and author Christian Wild on with us here. Christian, of course, you should take the supplement CoQ10 with this anyway, right?
Absolutely, and it is dose-related. The higher the dose on any of these statin drugs, the greater the chance of developing side effects.
Now, so you're recommending at least to patients, if your doctor has prescribed this drug, stay on it, don't panic, but if you've got that higher dosage, this 80 milligram, you should talk to the doctor about this.
Well, many people are overly conscious of their cholesterol. They're trying to drive it down so low, and it isn't really cholesterol that's dangerous. You have to have cholesterol. You can't survive without it.
That's true.
But it's the LDL that they need to concentrate on. And certainly, if they're taking any of the statin drugs or even the natural type, they've got to be on coenzyme Q10. As a matter of fact, you couldn't get a statin drug in Canada unless you read the warning, which said must be taken with CoQ10.
Sounds like you're going to be doing something on this story in your next newsletter.
I think I am. It's very timely, and I'm looking forward to being with you, Mr. Norrie, in a couple of days at the Health Freedom Expo in Chicago.
I will be there, and I shall see you there, Christian.
I think we're going to have a luncheon, one of those meet and greet.
We're going to do that first.
And we're going to get a chance to meet more of the Norrieites. I look forward to that.
You got it.
And you can still register online, I think, at the Health Freedom Expo to come and join us.
Yep, we got a link for you at the calendar section at coasttocoastam.com. A drug that makes hearts repair themselves has been used in research on mice. The damage caused by a heart attack had previously been considered permanent, but a study now in the journal Nature shows that a drug called thymosin beta-4, if used in advance of a heart attack, so I don't know how you're going to figure that one out, is able to prime the heart for repair. Maybe it's something that everybody just gets one of these shots. Here we go again. A lightning strike at a southern Mississippi military base sent 77 cadets to a hospital. The cadets enrolled in the Air Force Reserve Officer Training Corps at Camp Shelby. They were admitted after a bolt struck during a severe storm. Two cadets were transported by ambulance, the rest by bus. They were all very responsive and in stable condition. Osama bin Laden's deputy has warned that America faces not individual terrorists or groups, but an international community of Muslims that will seek to destroy it and its allies. Ayman al-Zawahiri was delivering a 28-minute videotape eulogy to the slain al-Qaeda leader Osama bin Laden, longtime the number two man, considered the network's operational head, also sought to cast a role for the terror group in the popular uprisings shaking the Arab world. Doug Hagman with us, investigates terrorist websites and the like. Doug, is this all rhetoric again, or what's going on?
Well, no, I think this is all interrelated, and I think that nothing could be better to give Ayman al-Zawahiri for his 60th birthday coming up next week than the uprisings going in progress across the Middle East this year that began in Lebanon on January 13th and continued through Tunisia and Egypt and so on. Based on what he had said in his 28-minute eulogy today, his objective is to undermine America's influence in the Middle East and across the world, across the Arab world. And I believe when he is talking about this Islamic Jihad attacking and ultimately destroying America, I believe he's referring to the Islamic Crescent, the Arab Spring. That's actually not a fight for democracy, but a springboard to the establishment of a caliphate across the Arab world. And I think that this is what we're talking about, and we have to watch this very closely, because I believe Zawahiri is in fact the spark plug behind this installation of Muslim Brotherhood beginning in Egypt and spreading throughout the Arab world.
Are we actively looking for him, Doug?
Well, you know, I'd like to think so. Certainly we have a good idea of where he's at. You know, we had a chance in 2004 in Peshawar to get him. We missed him then. Although we have a general idea of where he's at, I would like to believe that we are, in fact, actively looking for this individual.
All right, thanks. Doug Hagman, his website linked up on our Twitter feed at coasttocoastam.com. When Willie Nelson is on the road again, he'll be traveling without a Texas drug charge hanging over his head. A West Texas prosecutor said that the legendary singer and songwriter has pleaded no contest to a misdemeanor charge of possession of drug paraphernalia and has agreed to pay a $500 fine plus court costs of about $280. Hear that song, The Lion Sleeps Tonight, number one in 1961 on the charts. But in a moment, one of the original members of the Tokens, Philip Margot, joins us as we talk about his latest work. It's a sci-fi thriller. What happens when E.T.'s, the bad ones, come to this planet? Phillip's next with us on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, I'm George Norrie. So I'm scanning my emails yesterday, and I see one that says, "Hey, George, I've written this sci-fi book called The Null Quotient. I'm one of the original members of the Tokens. You might remember the group. My name's Philip Margot." And I went, how cool is this? And I went on to read it a little bit more. Well, let me tell you about our guest tonight, Philip Margot, the original founding member of the legendary band The Tokens, the creative force both in and out of the music business, helping him manage a number of people's careers. He's also an inventor, currently holding a patent on the spare pocket, which is an adjustable waist side carrying device. And his latest novel, just released, The Null Quotient, which is right down the coast-to-coast alley. Philip, first of all, this is a pleasure to meet you.
It's a pleasure to be here. I'm so delighted that you read my email and invited me. It's marvelous. That sounded like a pretty interesting guy, I guess. I don't know.
It was great.
Fooled you again.
Great timing. You know, I remember I don't want to say when I was a kid, but I remember The Lion Sleeps Tonight in the whimsical sound of all of that. How did that all come together?
Well, how did the record come together, or how did I come together?
You, because, the group, the record.
Well, yeah, I was an extraordinarily unspectacular kid. A nerd would have been an upgrade for me, because nerds at least are good at something.
Born in Brooklyn,
you know,
right?
Yeah, I was born in Brooklyn. I didn't care much about school. I didn't care much about anything, but I cared about being a kid, and I was good at that. And I had, you know, I built model airplanes. I played ball, and so on and so forth. And I didn't really pay much attention to school. I did the minimum so I could get through C's and D's. And I have my actual second grade report card here to show you, to prove that I'm not lying about this.
I believe you.
I didn't
you.
Make it up just for a story. Anyway, when I got to high school in my junior year, we were obliged to try out for the boys' chorus, which they were just starting. They were starting a new boys' chorus. And the music teacher, Mrs. Kate Durakis, made it mandatory for every boy in the class to try out. And when I went up on the platform and tried out, she played some notes and I sang them. She played a more combination of notes and I sang them. And she said, "Philip, you have a very, very good ear." And that was like the first time that the words "Philip" and "very good" were put in the same sentence.
That's super.
You know, and I took that and I used it and found out that I did have a good ear. I was blessed with a lucky thing.
Uh-huh.
That was my little lucky thing. And I learned the piano in about 3 months, well enough to start
That's
a band.
Lightning fast.
Yeah, well enough to start a band. And we did local Sweet 16s and stuff like that. And then we got a gig in the Catskill Mountains, which was like a great thing in 1959
sure.
for a high school graduate to go to the Catskill Mountains and be a musician. And then when we got back, my drummer, you know, show you how things make things happen. My drummer, his father won the New York State Lottery 2 months in a row. Okay.
Amazing.
And so my drummer was no longer my drummer. He went off to college.
Sure.
And I had to find a new drummer. And the new drummer knew this fellow, Hank Medress, who was in a group called Daryl and the Oxfords. And we got together and started, you know, writing and singing stuff. And all of a sudden, we had a group. And in 1959, December 7th, that was the day, first day we sang together. We sang Teenager in Love.
And, great song,
and it sounded
too.
Good. And from there, I mean, all kinds of things happened. Jay joined the group. So the group was my brother, Mitch Margot, and Hank Medress, and Jay Siegel, and myself. And we recorded a song called Tonight I Fell in Love, which happened because Hank met a woman on the BMT whose son was a producer. I mean, it's like, you talk about...
It's all magical.
Wow. You know, you talk about... You know, I don't even know what it is. It's like, you know... And then we had our first hit, Tonight I Fell in Love, and then we did a demo of Wimowa, which was... Wimowa is how you pronounce it, and W-I-M-O-W-E-H. It's not anything else, but... And it's a Zulu word derived from the Zulu word imbube,
okay.
which means lion. And we did this demo, and we got it to RCA, and RCA was interested, and they said, "Oh, we'd like to record this, but we'd like to write a lyric for it." And so our producers wrote a lyric. We did the recording session on July 27th, 1961, and they wanted us to sing the same melody as the chant for the lyric.
Uh-huh.
But then it had a melody repeating 6 times, and we thought it was boring. So we went over to the piano and changed the melody that went with the lyric, made it different from the melody that went with the chant, you know, the noodling. And the record, we finished the record, you know, we did 3 or 4 songs on that date in 3 hours. It was mixed over the phone.
I mean, amazing.
No, you know, it was 2-track. It was mixed over the phone. and then RCA... And then we went to RCA. We said, "Look, this was our last record on RCA. You know, it wasn't our first release. We had 2 releases before it." And when we went there and we said, "We don't think you should put it out. It's too weird. We love it, but it's weird." And because, you know, songs were "I Love You, You Love Me."
Right,
and here
right.
we are with "The Lion Sleeps Tonight."
Yeah,
you know,
with that rhythm behind it.
At any rate, RCA sent us home and said, "We're going to release it anyway." And they released it, but they went on the back side of it. They went on Tina, the flip side. And a disc jockey who just recently passed away, Dick Smith, in Worcester, Massachusetts, turned the record over and played "The Lion Sleeps Tonight." And from then on, bang.
It took off like a rocket. Hit number one for 3 weeks?
Yes, and it went from number 78 to 48 to 14 to 1, something like that with the jumps. You know, in 4 weeks, it was number one.
Philip, I like all kinds of music. I think some of our artists today are geniuses. Lady Gaga, Black Eyed Peas, all of them. The Beatles were great during their day. But the music of your era, in my era too, it was special. It had a sound. It was whimsical.
Yes, it was whimsical. It had these, you know, dip, 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 all of that stuff.
Would that work today?
You know what? We perform. You know, we still perform.
Yeah.
And we perform in front of younger people, not just, you would think, we do Leisure World, but we perform.
Well, my son's 28. He loves you guys.
Right. I think there's two things going on. One thing is that the media underrates this music. I'm talking about from a news standpoint. If news people would say, this stuff is great, because nobody ever comes to even review us when we perform.
You're
you know,
right.
This stuff is great, and it, which it is because they use it in advertising. They use it in movies constantly.
You were in The Lion King.
Right. I was in a, we were on a commercial with LeBron James and oh my God, Kobe, you know. Mm-hmm. And so, I mean, and it always shows up everywhere, you know. I mean, for the last 50 years, it shows up in commercials.
It lives forever.
Right. And so I think that the press kind of doesn't look at us as that important. They look at it, that was an era that was kind of like the beginning, which it was. I mean, the record business, we were nominated for a Grammy, right? We're nominated for a Grammy. We weren't invited to go to it. It took place in a hotel in Nashville, and we didn't get the Grammy.
So you'd be performing there today.
Right. And if we had a record decide the success of The Lion Sleeps Tonight, we'd be filling Dodger Stadium.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Anyway, and we finally got our nominating certificates 35 years later for the Grammy.
Oh,
I finally got one. You know, so it wasn't, it's not considered for some reason mainstream, I guess. It's relegated to the older folks. But the bottom line is it is mainstream because they use it in movies, as I said, in television, everywhere else. So why isn't it mainstream? What's not mainstream about it? It's not mainstream because they don't say it's mainstream. You know,
and it's a time in the business to be very creative because the days of the old vinyl records are gone, of course. The 8-tracks are gone. The CDs, in some cases, they're going to be gone. Everybody's downloading these things.
Right.
How would you, because you used to be a producer as well under some great names that you worked with.
Yes. Well,
what would you do if you were in the music business today as a major producer trying to get records out?
Okay. First of all, 20 years ago when all these innovations were happening, the record business was scared to death of it.
Mm-hmm.
And I kept saying, no, you don't understand. It's another channel of trade.
Grasp it.
You're missing. Hold on to it. It's going to help you. And they all said, no. And I don't know who runs the record industry anymore, but they don't do records. I don't know what they do. I do know what they do. They do product. It's art. And art requires a certain emotion. It requires a certain point of view. And it requires a certain ability. And I don't think that the records they're making today are the kind of records that people really want to hear. They will buy records because, as you say, Lady Gaga and people like that, they become sensations.
Mm-hmm.
But the bottom line is, I can't name over the last 10 years 10 great records that I heard. Can you?
No.
Whereas back then, we could name 10 a week.
Absolutely.
You know, so I think that if I were producing records today, I'd make records like I made yesterday. That's what I would do. I would use songs that had some emotion, that said something to people that they can understand, and I think it would work. You just look at what works in movies or what works on television or even on Broadway. You know, look at the success of the Four Seasons show.
The Jersey Boys.
The Jersey Boys. Yeah. That's not an accident.
And I love that show.
Right. It's wonderful. But it's the music is a romp through wonderful stuff. Bob Gordio's songs are just gems. And you don't hear that now. So I would start, if I were running the record business, I would start making real records again. I don't care what media, you know, and they made a big deal over downloading. We used to tape it with our web cores off the radio.
Of course.
I mean, they made it sound like it was a new thing. It's not new.
It's
always been happening. You know?
Exactly. By the way, you guys are going to be playing in Vegas, aren't
yes,
you?
Yes, we're at the Cannery. We're at the Cannery on September 4th.
That's
you know,
cool.
We get out. We get around. You know, we go to Florida a lot.
You
Montana.
Love life. You love life. You're married. You've got grandchildren.
I have 8 grandchildren. I have 3 kids, and I work with the spare pocket you mentioned. I invented with my son Joshua. My son and I, my son Noah and I. He's in the group. He plays drums for us. But we're also writing a book called Superhero School, which we're pretty excited about. And I produced a movie called Goddess of Love.
Yeah.
Back in 1988 with Vanna White.
Right.
We turned it into a play. And it's getting really great reaction. We made it a musical.
Good for you.
And so I am so delighted with what I'm doing because it's so much fun. And, you know, my wife says, well, you're working hard. I said, no, this is not work. This is fun.
It keeps you young, Philip. And when we come back in just a moment, I want to talk about your sci-fi thriller, because it could happen, believe it or not. It could happen. It's called The Null Quotient, and we'll be back with Philip Margo on Coast to Coast AM. Okay, next hour, we go live to the United Kingdom with Dr. David Darling as we talk about mega catastrophes. We're going to take your phone calls this hour with Philip Margo as we talk about his work on the tokens and also his latest work, The Null Quotient. It's a sci-fi book, and we'll get right into that when we come right back on Coast to Coast AM. Okay, welcome back to Coast. We're with Philip Margo, of course, from The Tokens, his book, The Null Quotient. We'll get your calls in just a second. Philip, how did you end up being a record producer and producer? How did that happen?
Well, with the records, it was, we had the hit record, The Lion Sleeps Tonight, but there was nowhere for us to perform. You know, we didn't want to go on the road with the, like, tours like where you did six shows a day and stuff like that.
That breaks you down after a while.
Right, and the money wasn't really that good. And there was no places to play. We weren't quite a college act because, you know, we weren't the Brothers Four or or any of those groups. So we decided that if we wanted to have a longevity in the business, we should get into producing. So we used The Lion Sleeps Tonight as a fulcrum to get us a production deal at Capitol Records. And we really didn't know much about producing, but we ran through our budget in 6 months. I mean, bam.
Yeah.
So we had no money to record. We just had some studio time to make demos, and the Chiffons come walking into our office. And they sing "He's So Fine."
He's So Fine.
And
we said, classic.
And we said, we got to record these girls. Yeah. Well, we had no money for musicians or an arranger or anything. Well, we played instruments. Let's do it ourselves. So I played the drums, and that's me on the drums.
Uh-huh.
And the other guys played the guitars and the piano and stuff like that, and the organ and the bass. And we made this record, "He's So Fine." And it wouldn't have been the record it was if we had gotten studio cats and gotten an arranger. It would have been an entirely different record.
Sure.
This way, it was a raw, funky record.
And
you know,
it worked.
If you remember. And 12 companies turned it down. Capitol turned it down. And we finally sold it. We brought it to Laurie Records. And Gene Schwartz and Elliot Greenberg closed the door and wouldn't let us out until we made the deal. They said, this record's a hit, and they were right. And that's what started us. And then we did One Fine Day. You know, Carole King said, I have a follow-up. And we did Denise by Randy and the Rainbows. And then we started to have a real name as producers. And we produced, The Happenings, Tony Orlando and Dawn. I mean, a whole bunch of really important records. So it was out of necessity because we wanted to stay in the business. And the same thing happened with movies. When I got involved with Robert Guillaume, I would be sitting in the green room while he was taping his shows, and I would be sitting with the executives of ABC. And I say, look, I had this idea. And they say, oh, good, bring it in. You know? And instead of going from the bottom, I went from the top. And when you go from the top, you make a sale.
That's exactly right.
And so I started getting things in development, but they would hire writers, and the writers wouldn't deliver, and the project wouldn't go forward. I finally said to them, look, let me write this next thing with my partners and if it turns out, then you pay us minimum and so on and so forth. Anyway, we wound up writing the script and it went to film. So it was called This Wife for Hire. Very proud of it. What? And I wrote movies for Gary Coleman, you know, when he was successful.
Yeah.
I wrote the last Love Boat episode with the original crew and different sitcoms, Who's the Boss. So, you know, I got a chance to really learn. And then I worked on the series, the Four Seasons that they made from Alan Alda made from his motion picture, The Four Seasons. And working with him was one of the greatest experiences of my life because he's a brilliant man and a brilliant writer.
Yeah.
And I learned more about writing from him than anybody, except maybe my former partner, Don Siegel. And, so, you know, flash forward to 100 years later, and I had this idea for a science fiction story, a television show, a movie, and I had no one to bring it to because I was, you know, I was now in my middle 60s. And you know what that means in this town, you know, it means you forgot how to write and you don't know where you are, you know. So
they think.
Yeah, right. But I don't know why. I don't understand it, but okay, you know. So I figured, hey, I'm never going to sell this as a television show or a movie because I don't have anybody to talk to. So I decided, I'll write a book. I'll see what happens. And I have a friend who was an editor, Beth Lieberman, and I said, take a look at this. Tell me if you think I have a book. And she said, you do. So
it's a great story. And we talk about things like this, Philip, where ancient civilizations, you know, might have had technology. An old craft was found in your book, what, about a million or so years ago?
Well, no, there's a craft that the initial concept of the book is that this planet is really 40 billion years old, not four billion.
Yeah.
And there have been 28 previous configurations of intelligent life that have risen from the slime and were destroyed destroyed themselves. They were destroyed by an outside force or they destroyed themselves. We're the 29th, teetering on the brink. And the whole thing gets launched by this archaeologist who is at the end of his career because he's a drunk, no good, not a nice man. Finds this craft in a Corrie glacier on Kodiak Island that looks like it's built for flight and dates back over a billion years.
Wow.
That's how it all gets rolling. And the interesting thing about this book,
which is all possible. You know that?
It's
possible.
I made up stuff that, you know, I make it, you know, one thing about science fiction is you got to make it plausible. It's, you know, obviously you can't make it work. And it always amazed me and amused me that Star Trek could go light speed because of dilithium crystals.
Mm-hmm.
You know, well, what the heck is a dilithium crystal and why does it make you go light speed? I don't know. So I felt that I owed the audience more. So the things that I created, I kind of explain in a very true sense, because I think that science fiction is like that.
It's almost like fact when you read it.
You should make it sound plausible, you know, hopping from dimension to dimension, going a whole new form of cold fusion propulsion, inertia canceling on a device that flies so that you can go from 0 to 10,000 miles an hour in a split second and not become oatmeal, you know, and things like that.
And it's just out today, isn't it?
Well, it's out now. Yeah, it's out.
Yeah,
it's out.
Right now.
And it's on. You can get it on Amazon. You can get it on Barnes & Noble and Kindle. It's on Kindle, too,
everywhere.
I'm very happy to say. And the interesting thing about it also is that...
Now, this is a great juxtaposition. The guy who came out with the song on vinyl records has a book out on Kindle.
Right. I know. I love it. And there's two of the three main characters are female. I just love women.
It could be a movie.
Yes, it could be. It could
Let's take a few calls and talk more about your book, okay? Lots of folks want to talk with you. John, truck driving in Idaho, first of all. Hey, John, welcome to the program.
Hi there.
Hi.
Hey, John.
I got a couple of questions for you. Is there any humor in that movie?
Yes, absolutely.
Or book, I should say.
Yes, there is. Yes, absolutely, because I can't help it. I can't help it when I see a joke, I go to it. Yes, there definitely is. It has. Go ahead.
Yeah, I just heard you saying there's some women. Where's the book set at? What locale would it be set in?
The book is set in the United States about 10 years from now.
Super.
It's set in the state in Washington in the desert in Arizona and in Kodiak Island
and
in Beverly Hills
something happens. We can't give it away though.
Well, I don't want to give away the whole story, I got some really nice reviews. Stan Lee, who created Spider-Man and Thor and all of those characters, gave me a beautiful write-up on it, which really made me feel great because he's kind of like an icon, and to impress him is a big deal.
Yeah.
And in fact, it's on the book and it's on my fan page. I have a author Philip F. Margo fan page 2 because my first fan page was hacked. It was building great. Somebody hacked
happens.
It and went away. And so, and the tokens.com, you know, is also, you can, you know, find some things about it. But it is on the fan page and there's a lot of nice quotes and reviews and on Amazon as well.
Let's go out to the Bronx, New York. John, you're with us on Coast to Coast. Hey, John.
Hi, how's it going, George?
Great, thanks.
Good. And Philip, how are you?
The Bronx, yes.
Yeah, one of my favorite songs,
Thank you.
Tonight. My gosh. Anyway, I wanted to know, what was your toughest challenge in the music business to date?
The toughest challenge today?
To date,
to date, yeah.
My toughest or the toughest to date?
For you.
For me, it was a ball.
See, we were a bunch of kids having a good time. I guess the toughest challenge is getting serious enough to really try to make a lot of money out of it, because we were like a bunch of otters running around making records and having a ball. So I suppose we were not as disciplined as we should have been.
Any career ups and downs because of the industry?
Always. Right. Every 2 months. I mean, it was like, you know, we would have a hit, then it would be quiet, then we'd have another hit, then it would be quiet, then, you know, then I think in the summer in June of 1970, I had just bought a house and I was wondering how I was going to pay for it. And then we produced and released Candida and Knock Three Times and Tie Yellow Ribbon. And that's how my house got paid for. You know,
when you would see groups like the Beach Boys and the Beatles start rolling in, how competitive did you guys kick in?
We didn't. We didn't. We were all, you know, I mean, the Beatles, we didn't have any contact with, really.
Yeah.
The Beach Boys, we knew. We know, we met several times. As a matter of fact, the song Don't Worry Baby, which was written by the Beach Boys, Roger Christian, and was very successful for them, we did a version of it where we asked permission to change the lyric of the second verse to make it not a car song, because it was a car song.
Okay.
And they gave us permission, and we, you know, they gave us a little piece of the song, which was very nice, because we only wanted to do it. We weren't looking to get a piece, but they were very kind. And sure enough, B.J. Thomas recorded that version. It became a hit.
Brian Wilson, genius.
All of those things, good vibration. There were two things that happened. When I heard Sgt. Pepper and I heard their album and the marvelous work they did, not from the beginning, but the stuff he did later on, which is so brilliant, you know.
He was looking for that sound.
Yes, and he found it. And you know, I said, how can we compete with that? You know, I mean, how can we compete with Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Heart? Who could compete with that? But yeah, we kept making hit records. So I guess we did, in a way. I mean, we couldn't get to their stage, but we, you know, over the 10 years that we were producing records, we had 11 gold records by, you know, as producers, which isn't bad.
How'd you get the name, The Tokens?
That's a great question. We wanted to, originally we were called Those Guys. We wanted to call ourselves Those Guys. Now, could you imagine in 1960 calling themselves Those Guys? That was because we wanted.
What's the name of the group? Those Guys.
Hey, here they are, ladies and gentlemen. Those Guys.
Yeah, it's like you forgot the name of the group, right?
Right, but it was fun. But Morty Kraft, who was going to release the record, didn't want to use the name Those Guys, and he had Neil Sedaka and the Tokens on Melba Records a couple, three years earlier. So he said, I want to use that name. And we just wanted our record out. So we settled on that name, and that was it. I mean, it wasn't that we chose it. It chose us.
Neil had a classic with Breaking Up Is Hard to Do, huh?
Well, he had a classic with everything. Neil's brilliant, too. He's a brilliant, brilliant
artist.
And
he's still performing.
Yes, he does. Yes, we did a show with him in Hawaii a couple of years ago.
That's great. Let's go to Blue Springs, Missouri. It's Bill's turn on Coast to Coast. Hey, Bill, go ahead. You're on with Phil Margo.
How you doing, George and Phil?
Hey, Bill.
Nice to talk to you. It's a pleasure.
Me too.
The Tokens, the Lion Sleeps Tonight, it was such a classic. I mean, I love pop music. I play all kinds of music, but I love pop too. And I was just wondering, how do you guys come up with the lyrics and the music and everything? I mean, today people do other people's songs. The singers can't really sing, some of them. And it's all push-button guitars and everything. You know, it is so brilliant. It's just, I can't even write a song. I can play a guitar, but
If you tried, you could. I think it was just we had a point of view, a musical point of view. We had an idea how we wanted to do it. And we just, you know, we didn't know any better. You know, in other words, we didn't think about it. I'll tell you one trick. One trick is this. Don't think too much. Just do it.
Do it.
That's what we did. We just sang the song. We stood in front of the mics. Our producers wrote the lyrics. They handed us the day of the session, and we kind of ginned up a melody to go with the lyrics that they wrote, and we just sang it. And I think when they say just do it, that's what they mean. I find that anything that I contrived was garbage. But when I did something out of my heart, like the book, which just came poured out of me every day, or like The Lion Sleeps Tonight, or like when we recorded He's So Fine, or all of those things, anything I did well, and my children and grandchildren, of course, and my picking my wife, that always worked out. It always worked
out. Just let it happen.
Don't think about it too much. Just do it.
It's like life, Phil.
Yes.
You know, when you concentrate, when you push, nothing happens. But you sit back.
Yeah, you just got to, you know, it's very Taoist. It's like, you know, the uncarved block.
Absolutely.
You just do it.
In the song, The Lion Sleeps Tonight, where are you in that song?
I'm baritone. I sing the bottom Wimoway part. Oh, Wimoway, oh, Wimoway, oh, Wimoway. Oh, that's me.
Okay.
That's me. I do the Wimoways. and of course, you know, because of our efforts, we had a group. And we have a whole bunch of wonderful things that we did.
You harmonized.
And stuff that we have now, even our recent stuff. We have a CD called Oldies Are Now and a CD called Tonight the Lion Dances, Esta Noche el León Baila. The Tonight the Lion Dances is a kind of a doo-wop, Latin doo-wop dance album. It's half in Spanish and half in English.
I'm not going to ask you how much you guys made on The Lion King for the rights of that, but did you do okay?
No, we didn't. That's a whole other story. We didn't get credit for writing the song, okay? And years later, when we finally realized we should have done something about it, it was too late.
Ah.
So we didn't. What we got from The Lion King was the fact that the record was released and was a hit again.
And people started buying it.
And it brought us, a whole new audience. It gave us a whole new relevancy. So even though we didn't make any money on the song, because of the popularity and the fact that it was being used in commercials, when our record is used, then we make money.
Do you guys still get little checks in?
We get
royalties.
I don't know what you consider little. I don't think they're little. I think they're fairly substantial.
I can't ask you, but I mean,
no,
they just
but they're
keep
fairly. They're well. Let's.
How often do they come in?
There's two amounts of money in my life: under $100 and over $100.
Okay.
These checks are over $100, and they come in every 6 months.
They just roll in.
Well, they come in by mail, you know. But also, you know, a lot of things I did, I get in the mail, which is nice, you know. I mean, you know, the stuff that, you know, when I was managing Robert Guillaume, hello, Robert, we got a substantial piece of the show eventually.
That was smart.
And so when that money comes, I get some of it.
That was smart. Let's see if we can get Dana in Tulsa, Oklahoma.
Dana,
we only have a minute left. Dana, go ahead.
Oh, George, this is great. I was 14 when The Lion Sleeps Tonight came out, and all of the Token songs are my favorites. I've got them bookmarked. I listen to them every day.
Oh, cool.
But Philip, my favorite song was Greatest Moments in a Girl's Life. It came out right after I got back from Vietnam. It will always be my favorite.
Oh, that's so cool. Stephen Friedland wrote that song. That's terrific. I'm glad. You know, I always get a kick when people remember or say nice things about some of the records that we did that not a lot of people know. You know what I mean? I'm delighted that you said that. And yes, it's a pleasure. And check out our website, thetokens.com. You'll see
I've got it bookmarked, and I just wish you all were still recording today.
Oh, yeah, we are. Well, we are, actually. We are.
Right.
We are.
Right.
We just started a whole new project, so we
good
are
for
recording.
You. Good. Dana, thanks for
thank
the call.
Thank you, Dana.
Calls from all over the place. Philip, we're out of time. I want to thank you. Good luck with the book, The Null Quotient. More importantly, you're welcome anytime you want.
I would be delighted. I always find it a pleasure. I enjoy it. Hey, I'm a showbiz guy.
You got it. Thank you.
And
you're one of the good guys.
Thank you. Thank you. So are you. Thank you so much.
And we'll be back in a moment. Dr. David Darling, as we go live to the United Kingdom on Coast to Coast AM.